in causal inference, our absolute biggest enemy is, well, it is the missing counterfactual.
Right, the alternate timeline that we literally cannot see.
Exactly. It is like it's like trying to measure the exact impact of an intense, I don't know, month-long study regimen on your final exam score.
Yeah.
You put in the hours, you sit down for the exam, and you get an A.
Which is great, obviously.
Sure, yeah. But to truly know the causal effect of all that studying, you would need to peer into an alternate timeline where you just played video games instead and, you know, see what you scored there.
And because we cannot observe two simultaneous realities, that alternate timeline is just fundamentally unobservable. We are forced to mathematically reconstruct it using whatever observational data we happen to have available.
I mean, everything in causal design ultimately comes down to how believably you can build that ghost timeline, right?
Exactly. It all comes down to the credibility of your counterfactual.
Okay, so let's unpack this. We are doing a deep dive today into a classic comparative case study that serves as, honestly, the perfect training ground for understanding the methodological mechanics of synthetic difference in differences.
Yeah, SDID is incredibly powerful, but you really have to understand the mechanics under the hood.
Right, and for those of you wrestling with program evaluation or applied microeconomics right now, we are going to use California's 1988 Proposition 99 to explore how this estimator actually works.
Which is a fantastic data set to use.
It really is. So for context, back in November of 1988, California voters passed Prop 99. It raised the cigarette excise tax by 25 cents a pack, which was a massive jump at the time. And it earmarked those revenues to fund aggressive anti-smoking campaigns.
And the core question for researchers here is entirely causal. Did this specific policy intervention actually reduce smoking rates in California?
Right. But to answer that with any degree of academic rigor, we first have to clearly define what we were even looking for, don't we?
We do. We have to formally define our estimand. Because California, you know, it wasn't randomly assigned to pass this tax, so this is strictly an observational design.
Okay.
So the estimand we are trying to isolate is the average treatment effect on the treated, or the ATT.
And conceptually, that is just the difference between the observed outcome and the counterfactual.
Exactly. It's the difference between California's actual cigarette sales per capita after 1988 and the unobserved counterfactual, which is, you know, what California's sales would have been if Prop 99 had failed. And we just average that difference over the entire post-intervention period.
Right. So every statistical method we apply to this data is really just a different algorithm for guessing that unobserved counterfactual.
That is exactly the right way to think about it.
And before we dive into the specific mechanics of synthetic difference in differences, or SDID, we really need to understand the two older foundational methods that it merges together.
Right, because you can't understand the innovation without understanding what came before it.
Exactly. We have standard difference in differences, and we have the synthetic control method. And what is incredibly helpful about the recent literature, specifically the foundational 2021 framework by Arkhangelsky and his co-authors, is that it proves we don't have to think of these as completely separate models.
Yeah, that was a huge breakthrough in how we teach this.
I mean, we can view difference in differences, synthetic control, and SDID as just three variations of a single weighted two-way fixed effects regression.
What's fascinating here is just how clarifying that unified framework really is. If you strip away the complexity, the core regression is essentially just trying to predict cigarette sales using four basic components.
Okay, break those down for us.
Sure. First, you have a baseline average. Second, you have unit fixed effects, or state level fixed effects here. These account for the fact that some states just naturally smoke more or less than others on average.
Right, like completely independent of the tax.
Exactly. Culturally or demographically, they just have different baselines. Third, you have time-fixed effects, which capture national trends, like the fact that smoking was, you know, generally declining everywhere in the 1980s anyway.
Because of changing attitudes and health warnings, right?
Right. And finally, you have the treatment indicator, which isolates the specific impact of the policy itself.
Okay, so if that is the master equation, what actually differentiates the three methods?
The only thing that differentiates them is how they apply mathematical weights to the control states and the pretreatment years to actually fit that equation.
Okay, let's run the classic difference in differences through that lens.
Yeah.
If DID is just a version of this equation, how is it applying those weights?
Well, it doesn't apply them at all. Difference in differences is the unweighted special case.
Wait, unweighted?
Yeah. It assumes that every single control state and every single pretreatment year is equally informative. It just gives uniform weight across the entire board.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the entire credibility of DID-D rests on the parallel trends assumption. It basically argues that if Prop 99 hadn't passed, California's smoking rate would have moved in exact lockstep with the simple, unweighted average of the 38 control states that didn't pass a similar tax.
Wait, hold on. If standard DID-D just gives every control state the exact same weight, like 1 over 38, isn't that a massive mathematical vulnerability?
It absolutely can be, yes.
Because I am looking at the raw data for California in the 1980s, and California was already on a drastically different smoking trajectory than the rest of the country before the tax even passed.
Right, they were already trending downward faster.
Yeah, they were smoking less than the national average, and the rate of decline was noticeably steeper. Comparing California to a simple, unweighted average of 38 highly heterogeneous states, I mean, states with completely different cultures and baseline smoking habits, that just seems mathematically reckless.
It is reckless in this specific context, which is exactly why unweighted difference in differences is so heavily criticized. When your baseline trajectories are clearly diverging like that, you are baking bias into your counterfactual from the very start.
Which is what pushed researchers toward the original synthetic control method, right?
Exactly. Synthetic control attempts to fix this by applying optimized weights to the units. So instead of a simple average, it builds a synthetic California by assigning specific data-driven weights to just a handful of control states.
So it forces their combined average to perfectly track California's actual smoking pass before 1989.
Right. It matches the trend.
But there is a crucial mechanical trade-off when you use classic synthetic control. I mean, it gives us those optimized state weights. But to do so, it completely drops the state-level fixed effects from the equation.
Right.
And it doesn't use time weights at all.
Yeah. The omission of those state-level fixed effects is really the defining limitation of classic synthetic control. A fixed effect is essentially a mathematical shock absorber. It absorbs the baseline differences between the units.
So what happens when you drop it?
Well, by dropping it, synthetic control forces the algorithm to build a comparison group that perfectly matches California's pre-period trend and its exact pre-period level. It demands absolute equivalence in the raw numbers, not just the general shape of the curve.
That seems like a painfully tall order.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't forcing the control group to perfectly match the baseline level going to cause the model to just fail if California happens to have uniquely low or high smoking rates?
Oh, it frequently causes the method to fail. If no natural combination of donor states happens to sit at the same baseline level as your treated state, the algorithm will just struggle to find a valid synthetic control.
Because it's trying to match the exact height on the axis, basically.
Right. It is an incredibly demanding restriction.
Okay, this perfectly tees up the core innovation of our deep dive today. Because standard difference in differences assumes way too much by relying on simple averages, and synthetic control demands way too much by forcing exact level matching. We naturally arrive at the need for an estimator that navigates between these two extremes.
And that is exactly what synthetic difference in differences does. It is the literal mathematical marriage of those two concepts.
So what does it borrow from DID?
It brings back the state-level fixed effects. And this is a massive relief, mechanically speaking, because it means SDID allows for a constant parallel-level gap between California and the synthetic control group.
Oh, okay. So they don't have to perfectly overlap on the graph anymore.
Exactly. They just have to move together. But simultaneously, it adopts the optimized state weighting from synthetic control. So you are comparing California to a weighted average of states that actually share its behavioral trends rather than just relying on some naive national average.
Let's get under the hood and look at how it actually chooses those weights, because I feel like that is where the magic happens here. We have two sets of weights to worry about, right? The state weights and the time weights.
Yes, two distinct optimization problems.
Let's start with how it weights the control states.
Okay, so the algorithm looks for non-negative weights that sum to one, deliberately trying to make the weighted average of the control states mirror California's pre-treatment trend. But SDID introduces a crucial regularization tool right here, which is a ridge penalty.
Okay, a ridge penalty? How should we visualize that?
Think of the ridge penalty as a mathematical governor. Left to its own devices, a standard optimization algorithm might just lazily dump 100% of the weight onto a single control state that happens to look a lot like California just due to random noise.
So the ridge penalty stops that?
Yes. It actively penalizes the model for concentrating the weights too heavily on any one state.
So it essentially forces the algorithm to spread the influence out over a much larger number of states,
yeah.
which I imagine gives you a much more stable, less noisy comparison group.
Exactly. It creates a more diffuse donor pool. You are trading a tiny, tiny fraction of your pre-period fit for a massive gain in out-of-sample stability.
That makes total sense. And then we have the time weights. When I first read this paper, this seemed like the real secret weapon of SDID. Because standard synthetic control treats every single pretreatment year as equally important, right?
It does. But SDID completely upends that. It optimizes the time weights by looking at the pretreatment years and asking a very specific question. Which of these historical periods actually do the best job of predicting the post-treatment era for the control group?
So it's aligning the pre-period average with the post-period average.
Right. The years that share the same macroeconomic conditions or general smoking trends as the post-1988 world get heavily upweighted. And the distant past, which might just be full of completely irrelevant noise, gets downweighted frequently all the way to zero.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me, trying to visualize this. If classic synthetic control is like trying to cast an exact body double for a movie, you know, the double has to be the exact same height, weight, and look precisely like the actor in every single way. That is the strict level matching.
I like that, yeah.
But SDID is more like finding a stunt double. The stunt double just has to move and act like the actor. They don't have to be the exact same height because the camera angles, or in our case, the fixed effects, will just absorb that constant height difference.
That's a great way to put it.
And the time weights mean the casting director is only watching the stunt double's most recent action reels to predict if they can do the job tomorrow. They completely ignore a commercial the stunt double filmed back in 1972 because how you moved in 1972 is utterly irrelevant to how you move today.
That analogy perfectly captures the dual mechanics at play here. You have the relaxation of the absolute level constraint, which allows for a much broader pool of viable candidates, and that is combined with the strict temporal prioritization that just filters out irrelevant historical data.
Well, theory is great, but as graduate students, you eventually have to sit down in front of a computer, open Stata, and actually run the data. So let's talk about the practical implementation of this. We're referencing the comprehensive tutorial and the specific STEED Stata package developed by Clark, Pollinier, Athey, and Imbens in 2024.
And the structural elegance of their Stata package is that it literally forces you to recognize the unified framework we just discussed.
How so?
Well, in Stata, you don't use three completely different commands with different syntaxes to run these three models. You use one single unified command, and you simply toggle the method option.
Oh, that's clean?
Very clean. You type method did, method C, or method std. It executes all three within the exact same underlying architecture, which basically guarantees that your estimation, your standard errors, and your generated graphs are perfectly comparable across the models.
I am looking at the output for all three models run on the Prop 99 data right now, and the differences are pretty striking. Let's start with the basic difference in differences. Running that unified command gives us an estimated treatment effect of negative 27.35 packs per capita.
Okay.
Meaning, according to GIDD, the Prop 99 tax reduced smoking in California by over 27 packs per person per year compared to the national average.
But we know from our earlier discussion about the raw data that this number is highly, highly suspect.
Because of the pre-existing trends.
Exactly. Because the unweighted control group's average was already diverging from California's steeper decline before the policy even passed, that negative 27 packs actually includes the natural divergence that was going to happen anyway. It wildly overstates the policy's true impact.
So we switch the option to synthetic control, and the output for method drops the estimate down to roughly negative 19.5 packs per capita. Looking at the diagnostic output, it achieves a very tight pre-period fit. The root mean squared error is a remarkably low 1.66.
But look at how it gets that fit.
Right. To get that perfect fit, it is leaning incredibly hard on just three states. Utah, Montana, and Nevada make up the vast majority of the synthetic California.
Which highlights the exact vulnerability we discussed earlier. Without the ridge penalty to force a diffuse distribution, classic synthetic control acts like a spotlight, highlighting just a few donor states that happen to mechanically match California's baseline level.
And finally, we run SDID. The output for SDID returns a treatment effect of negative 15.60 packs per capita.
Which is still roughly a 20% reduction in smoking.
Undeniably a massive public health victory. But mathematically, it is the smallest magnitude of the three estimators. Can we trace that conservative estimate back to the specific mechanics we talked about?
We can trace it directly to the two innovations we outlined. First, look at the state weights in this data output. Because of that Ridge penalty, SDID does not put all its chips on Utah, Montana, and Nevada. It diffuses the weights across roughly 20 different control states.
Wow, 20. That's a huge difference.
It is. It builds a much broader, more fundamentally stable comparison group that is far less vulnerable to a random shock hitting just one of those states.
And the time weights.
Second, and this is probably the most critical driver of the conservative estimate, the algorithm determined that the smoking environment of the 1970s and early 1980s was simply not predictive of the late 1980s. So it placed 100% of the pre-period weight strictly on the years 1986, 1987, and 1988. It completely zeroed out the entire history from 1970 to 1985.
So by forcing the model to only look at the 3 years immediately preceding the tax, it essentially tightened the leash. But, I mean, put yourself in the shoes of a researcher trying to publish this paper. Why on earth would I actively choose the model that gives me the smallest, least flashy treatment effect? Wouldn't the negative 27 packs from the DEGT model just generate better headlines?
It might generate headlines, but this raises an important question about what actually constitutes rigorous empirical work. Academic economics does not reward the largest effect size. It rewards the most robust identification strategy. The exact parallel trends assumption required by DIGI is just incredibly fragile in observational data. SDID shrinks the point estimate precisely because it successfully strips out the upward bias caused by using a flawed, unweighted comparison group. And it strips out the historical noise of the 1970s.
So it's a trade-off for credibility.
Exactly. A smaller, highly credible estimate that actually survives rigorous methodological scrutiny is infinitely more valuable than a massive estimate built on easily disproven assumptions. The negative 15.60 is really the only defensible number here.
The logic definitely holds up.
Yeah.
So we have our point estimate. We can confidently defend negative 15.60. But as anyone who has ever taken a graduate econometrics course knows, a point estimate without a standard error is practically useless.
Completely useless. We have to do inference.
We have to prove this result isn't just statistical noise. And here we hit a massive structural wall, don't we? Prop 99 happened in exactly one state. We have an N of one treated unit.
Yeah, the single treated unit constraint dictates our entire approach to inference moving forward. When you only have one treated unit, your standard toolkit completely falls apart.
Give me an example.
Consider the jackknife method, which is an absolute staple for calculating variance. The jackknife works by systematically dropping one unit from the data set at a time, rerunning the model, and measuring how much the estimate changes.
But if our only treated unit is California.
Exactly. If you drop California to run a jackknife iteration, your model instantly collapses because you no longer have a treatment variable to evaluate. The math is literally undefined.
Okay, what about bootstrapping then? I mean, bootstrapping is the default solution for almost everything else in modern economics. Why can't we just bootstrap the standard errors here?
Because the bootstrap relies heavily on asymptotic theory. It assumes that as your sample size grows, your sample distribution closely approximates the population distribution.
Right.
But in a block design like this, where the treatment is applied to exactly one unit at exactly one time, the number of treated units isn't growing. It's stuck at one. If you try to sample with replacement from a pool of one treated state, you are just drawing California over and over and over again. It does not yield a valid approximation of the true sampling variance.
Okay, so the jackknife is mathematically undefined, and the bootstrap is asymptotically invalid. How do we actually calculate a standard error for this 15.60-year drop in cigarette sales?
We have to rely on a placebo or permutation procedure, which is a brilliant workaround for the N of one problem.
How does it work?
The logic is pretty straightforward. We keep our donor pool of 38 control states. We then systematically assign a fake placebo treatment to each of those 38 states, one at a time.
So we pretend that, like, North Carolina passed Prop 99 in 1989.
Yes. We run the SDID algorithm and calculate the treatment effect for North Carolina. Then we pretend Texas passed it and calculate the effect for Texas. And we do this for all 38 control states.
And because we know none of these states actually passed the policy,
any effect we measure is purely random noise.
Oh, I see. So by doing that 38 times, we build a distribution of pure noise, a distribution of placebo effects. And the spread of that noise becomes our variance.
That is exactly it.
I am actually looking at the data output for this exact procedure right now. If we use the normal approximation confidence interval based on that placebo variance, Stata reports a standard error of 9.88. If we construct a 95% confidence interval around our estimate of negative 15.6 here, it ranges from negative 35.0 all the way up to positive 3.8.
Okay.
That interval crosses zero.
It does cross zero, yes. Which means, strictly speaking, under a normal approximation, we cannot reject the null hypothesis of no effect at the conventional 5% significance level.
I have to admit, that is incredibly deflating. We do all this advanced math, we integrate the fix effects, we apply the ridge penalty, we optimize the time weights, and at the end of the day, we have to write in our paper that the result isn't even statistically significant.
Well, this is where understanding the limits of normal approximation is absolutely vital and why the literature requires dual reporting for these specific designs. The normal approximation interval is very wide, which honestly reflects the sheer lack of precision you have when studying a single state. But we can look at that exact same distribution of 38 placebo effects through a totally different lens, which is a rank-based permutation test. Instead of assuming a normal distribution, we just look at the raw rankings.
Okay, so what do we ask?
We ask a very simple question. Out of those 38 control states, how many produced a purely random placebo effect that was as large or larger than California's actual estimated drop of 15.6 CQ?
Looking at the visual distribution in the tutorial, almost all of the placebo effects for the control states are tightly clustered right around zero, exactly as you'd expect for states where nothing happened.
Precisely. In fact, if you rank them, only one out of the 38 control states randomly generated a drop as severe as California's.
Just one.
Just one, and one out of 38 gives us a permutation p-value of roughly 0.026.
Oh, wow. So under the rank-based test, the result is statistically significant at the 5% level.
It is. So an honest, transparent summary of your findings requires you to report both metrics. The wide confidence interval acknowledges that our magnitude is imprecise because we only have one state to study, but the rank-based p-value proves that observing a 15-pack drop purely by random chance is highly unlikely.
That is incredibly elegant. So what does this all mean when you pull it together? Let's quickly summarize the toolkit. STID elegantly integrates the best features of its predecessors. It uses a ridge-penalized unit weight to build a diffuse, stable comparison group. It employs optimized time weights to fiercely prioritize only the most predictive historical data, cutting out decades of irrelevant noise.
Yep.
And it retains state-level fixed effects, ensuring that we don't demand impossible baseline equivalents from our control states. When you apply this highly robust framework to the Prop 99 data, it filters out the bias noise of standard methods and delivers a conservative, highly defensible reduction of about 16 cigarette packs per capita. And we secure that finding using a placebo permutation test to navigate the strict limitations of a single treated unit.
That is a perfect summary. Though, as a final note for anyone designing their own research around this, we must remember that mathematical sophistication cannot override fundamental research design flaws.
Of course.
Even STID relies on strict assumptions. For instance, the placebo inference we just mapped out assumes homoscedasticity across units, because we are essentially using the variance of the control states to represent the variance of the treated state.
Right.
More importantly, the identificational strategy still completely assumes there were no other unobserved concurrent shocks hitting California in 1989 that might have impacted smoking, and it assumes zero spillovers. If Prop 99 simply caused Californians to drive across the border to Nevada to buy cheaper cigarettes, then our donor pool is contaminated, and the entire estimate is hopelessly biased.
Yeah, you cannot mathematically fix a leaky border.
As you take these tools back to your own data sets, I want to leave you with one final thought about the boundaries of this method. Throughout this entire breakdown, we were entirely constrained by the fact that Prop 99 happened in one state at one specific time, right? A block design.
Yeah.
But what if you are evaluating a policy that rolled out gradually?
That changes things completely.
Exactly. What if five states adopted a policy in 1990, 10 more adopted it in 1995, and three more in 2000? How does staggered adoption actually change the underlying math of the time weights? And more importantly, if you have multiple treated units spread across time, does that finally unlock the asymptotic justification to bring the bootstrap or the jackknife back into your inference strategy? Think about how the architecture we discussed today expands when time is no longer fixed. Keep that in mind as you map out your own designs, because ultimately, your causal estimates are only ever as credible as the alternate timeline you managed to build.